Bruce Dern has acquired the reputation of being one of the most talented and prolific actors of his generation. He turns 80 years old on Saturday, the same day he'll be honored with a tribute at the Berkshire International Film Festival. He'll be in conversation with famed film director Douglas Trumbull, who directed Dern in the 1972 classic Silent Running. Their talk will be followed by a screening of the Oscar-nominated Nebraska at the Mehewe Theater in Great Barrington at 7 p.m. In the film Nebraska, directed by Alexander Payne, Dern plays Woody Grant, who goes on a road trip after believing a magazine scam that announces he's won $1 million and just has to get to Nebraska to claim the prize. But his son, played by Will Forte, intervenes.
So you told the sheriff that you were walking to Nebraska?
That's right. To get my $1 million.
What $1 million?
We are now authorized to pay $1 million to Woodrow T. Grant of Billings, Montana.
Let me see that.
And your mother won't take me.
Mega Sweepstakes Marketing. Dad, this is a total come-on. It's one of the oldest gimmicks in the book. I didn't even know they still did it anymore.
Well, I can't say it if it's not true.
They're just trying to sell you magazines.
It says I won.
So mail it in. I'll help you.
I'm not trusting the mail with $1 million.
Dern was nominated for an Oscar and won the Cannes Film Festival Best Actor Award for his work in that film. It is a great pleasure to welcome Bruce Dern to the roundtable this morning. Bruce, thank you very much for joining us. What an honor.
Well, thank you, sir, for doing your homework and being there, and for the Berkshire people to even ask me.
Well, it's very nice, and it'll be very nice to have you in town, and especially with the showing of Nebraska, which I assume, even though it's been a few years, is a film you're still proud of.
I would say more than proud. I was thrilled to be a part of it. The guy always fought for me. Took us 10 years to get it made. He always defended me, Alexander Payne. And at first, a lot of people didn't want me, didn't want to make the movie, would not make it in black and white. There were all kinds of problems that way, but we got it made, and Alexander stuck with me, and we made it in black and white. And there was a comment at one time from one of the jefes at Paramount that said, "Who's going to give a shit about an old geezer from a flyover state?" We convinced him then that he was wrong, that we had to tell him, I had to tell him to his face, actually, that it may be a flyover state from you, but the state itself, along with the area it's in, is called the heartland of America. So shut the up, because that's where it is in this country. And those people still dare to dream, which is something I don't know that a lot of other people do anymore. Did that change his mind? No. He still fought black and white for a long time, but they finally ended up taking $15 million out of their budget and letting us go make it.
I'm curious about something you said, though, of not wanting you. Why wouldn't a studio want you?
Because they needed a big movie star, and I wasn't a big movie star. I've starred in movies. I don't ever consider myself a movie star. I've always felt that if you're going to play Hollywood trivia, a movie star is somebody who dominates a decade above the title of a movie. Now, have I done that? Yes, I have. But I'm not the first choice in the geezer variety. I wasn't then. Hopefully, because of endurance, I'm hanging in there and getting a little more opportunity. It is what it is. You don't belittle the fact. I mean, in Silent Running, I was 17th choice. Ask Douglas. He'll tell you, well, they kept saying, no, we need a star. Well, it was 1971, and the only thing I'd ever been in where I was a star of it was a Jack Nicholson movie called Drive, He Said, which I won the National Film Critics Award for Best Supporting Actor, and nobody ever saw it. And you never get over it. But I didn't come here to be a star. I told Quentin Tarantino the last day of Hateful Eight, when I left the set, I put my hands on his shoulders and I said, I want to tell you something, sir. I want to thank you for the opportunity to let me get better. And that's what he does, and that's what Alexander does. They write material where you, number one, got to be better to be in it. and you know Vince Lombardi or whoever it is, your leader, comes to you and says, I want you to play every down, that you got to play every down. Now, have I done it before? To a degree, but never greater than I did in Nebraska.
That's where you had your first drink?
Dad, just let me sip this beer.
So I guess you kept up that fine family tradition with Ross and me.
You liked it, as I recall.
I was like six.
A sip of beer ain't gonna kill you when you're 6 years old. I thought you drank. Come on, have a beer with your old man. Be somebody.
I've been trying to give it up.
What for?
I mean, it was starting to... It just wasn't helping.
Now you're all right.
Excuse me.
Yeah?
Can I have a beer too, please?
You betcha.
I'm gonna drink with my dad.
The greatest compliment, Joe, I ever got in my life was I'd not met Al Pacino. Al Pacino was at the party, and somebody said, you two guys should meet. So I said hello to him, and he said, hi, and I've been hearing all about your movie, but I haven't seen it yet. I didn't get a screener. So Brad Grey was in the room. I went to him and Adam Goodman, who was the other head of the studio, and I said, Al Pacino doesn't have a screener. And they said, tell him he'll have one with his paper tomorrow morning on his doorstep. Noon the next day, I get the greatest phone call in regards to phrase from Away Up There that I've ever had in my life. How he got my number, I don't know, but the phone rang. I picked it up. I said hello. And he said, Bruce, Al Pacino. I said, oh, how are you, sir? And I meant sir as sir. And he said, how did you do that? And I said, well, sir, and I told him what Alexander Payne said to me on the opening day, which was, do you see anything here at 7:45, our first day in the movie you've never seen before? I said, yes, Alexander, I do. I see everybody seems to be pulling their oar. Oh, hopefully that's because we have 88 crew members here and 61 have worked every day on every movie I've ever made. So you, sir, can dare to risk because we've got your back. And then he said, and this is Faden Papamichael, he's your cameraman, and I wonder if you might do something for Faden and I. We're not sure you've ever done in your career. And I said, well, what's that? And he said, never show us anything. Let us find it. I knew I had a partner for the first time in my life. On the other end of the phone, Al says to me, that's the perfect sentence. And he said, the reason I say that is I watched the performance, Bruce, and I never saw the work.
How did you and Mom end up getting married?
She wanted to.
You didn't?
I figured what the hell.
Were you ever sorry you married her?
All the time. Could have been worse.
Well, you must have been in love, at least at first.
Never came up.
Did you ever talk about having kids? Like how many you wanted and stuff like that?
Nope.
And why did you have us?
Because I like to screw. And your mother's a Catholic, so you figure it out.
So you and Mom never actually talked about whether you wanted kids or not?
Well, I figured if we kept on screwing, we'd end up with a couple of you.
Bruce Dern started his acting career doing guest shots on TV shows like Route 66, Ben Casey, Wagon Train, and Gunsmoke. In the 1960s, he co-starred in several Roger Corman films, including the biker film The Wild Angels and the psychedelic film The Trip, which was written by Jack Nicholson. Dern co-starred with Nicholson in the 1972 film The King of Marvin Gardens and was nominated for an Oscar for his performance in the 1978 film about Vietnam War veterans coming home.
If it's over with us, it's over!
Well, what are you saying, that you're not even going to make the effort?
What I'm saying is I do not belong in this house! Please. And they're saying that I don't belong over there!
Dern says at the beginning of his career there were three goals: go to New York, work for Elia Kazan, and become a member of the Actors Studio. So he quit college in Philadelphia and went and did just that.
When I began under contract to Mr. Kazan. And he told me two things the first day we were on a movie set. He had five of us under contract: Rip Torn, Pat Hingle, Bruce Dern, Lee Remick, and Geraldine Page. We did good. I was the kind of the baby of that group. And the first day on the set, he told me two things. First was, you like to say things I've seen in class that aren't in the script. They're really brilliant things because they come right out of you and they're always the character. They're not for you to look like you're clever or cute. They embellish the character. So when you do that, never ask permission. You go ahead and do it. When they turn the switch on, you don't rehearse it. You don't do it in rehearsal. I don't rehearse anyway. I rehearse for the camera. But why give away what might possibly be magic? So why not, once you got the moves all correct and everything, just turn the switch on and film it. See what might happen. And I said, well, how will I get away with that? He said, because the director has something you don't have, Bruce. I said, what's that? Take two. So that solved that. And then the other thing he told me, the day I left to go, Mr. Strasberg and him allowed me to go after almost three years with them. And he said, now look, you're going to Hollywood with our blessing. Understand something. No one is going to know who you are or treat you correctly until you're in your 60s. I said, Gadge, I'm 24 years old. What am I supposed to do? He said, you're going to play the fifth cowboy from the right. Just understand that. In most cases, your character won't even have a name. He'll have two or three lines, and that'll be it. You just make sure you're the most uniquely interesting fifth cowboy from the right that ever lived. And so that's what I came to Hollywood with. And I remember the first interview, not the first interview, but Harry Dean Stanton and I went on an interview one time, some TV show, to meet Lynn Stallmaster. And I learned a long time ago that when you go, he's a casting director, the biggest, one of the three biggest of the all time, but then at that time in 1961. And you don't have 5 minutes. You have 3 minutes because of the around, the introductions and everything. You have 3 minutes. So you don't have a chance to read well, impress anybody. So I don't read. I don't read well anyway. I'm not dyslexic, but I don't read well. If they'd have given me remedial reading, I'd have failed that. But I just knew to go into an interview, and he was on the telephone. When I went in the room, I went, grabbed the phone out of his hand and slammed it down on the cradle. And I said, I got 2.5 minutes left of my life and you're on the phone? And if you're trying to phone up some girl or something, I can get you one in 20 minutes. Will be better than anything you can get in a phone call. So what are you doing to me? And he says, there's a door. You get out and you take that guy outside who's wandering around also, who just sat in here, who's also got a little laid-back, rude game. And I said, I'm not laid back. He said, then just get out. You're too unprofessional. You'll never make it, ever. So get that. I just turned, and I went to the door. And at the door, he turned around, and he said, you have an interesting presence. So if you're ever in anything, please do let me know. And I turned back to him, and I looked him in the eye and walked within a foot of his face and put my finger on his chest and said, Mr. Stallmaster, I'm in your room, and walked out. As I got to the door, he yelled out, Mr. Dern. And I waited. He came to his door, and he said, they are doing a Gunsmoke this week. But if you ever say that I'm the one that told you to go over there, I'll have your SAG cards taken away from you. We believed him. What did we know? You could take a SAG card. We paid to be a member, but I didn't know you could be disallowed to work in SAG. So we kind of believed him. And he said, but they're doing an episode of Gunsmoke with the two most obnoxious brothers that have ever appeared on television in any kind of Western or anything else. tell your agents to call up and ask about it. But if it, you take it back to me, you're done. That was what I learned about auditioning. You know?
You've talked about Alexander Payne and Quentin Tarantino and people who have your back. When working with a great director, I mean, you had a film, obviously, which you tell a great story about with Alfred Hitchcock. I mean, do you notice his greatness at that point?
Okay, I felt I've worked for 6 directing geniuses, and I'm leaving out Frankenheimer, Hal Ashby, Mark Rydell, Sidney Pollack, Michael Ritchie, a lot of really wonderful directors. The 6 geniuses are not in order of who's the best, because they're all the best. Mr. Kazan, Mr. Hitchcock, Douglas Trumbull, Francis Coppola, Alexander Payne, and Quentin Tarantino. The reason they're geniuses is there is nobody who works on that set in that particular movie who cannot at any time during any day, as busy as they may look, go up to one of them and ask them, what is my specific contribution to this shot? And they'll tell you word for word. The others, why they're not geniuses, the whole package, is because they're not that approachable. Hal was certainly as brilliant and genius, if you are geniuses, as there can be. I mean, I saw him, something the history will show you. What he did in 5 months is just absolutely unbelievable in terms of genius. He is not easily approachable, and neither was Frankenheimer, and neither but it. But the other guys are all a bit professorial and academic in that they like to teach and explain how they're making films their way. And that's why they will tell you and answer your question and be excited that you ask it. It's an extraordinary thing, and it's a gift, but they have it. I just always thought that that's genius. So it's the whole package. Every single day I went to work with any one of those directors, I was excited to go to work every single day, and particularly with Douglas, because you just were excited to go to work because you thought that day any one of them just might do something that's never been done. That's why I don't miss work those days. Have I been late? Never more than 20 minutes.
Never more than 20 minutes. One of those genius directors he mentioned, Douglas Trumbull, will be in conversation with Bruce Dern on Saturday night at the Mahaley Theater in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. It's all part of the Berkshire International Film Festival. We'll hear the second part of my interview with Bruce Dern after a short break, but first a scene from the 1972 film Silent Running, starring Bruce Dern and directed by Douglas Trumbull.
What do you want, Lowell? I mean, there's hardly any more disease, there's no more poverty. Nobody's out of a job.
That's right. Every time we have the argument, you say the same thing to me. You give me the same 3 answers all the time. The same thing. Well, everybody has a job. That's always the last one. But you know what else? There is no more of, my friend. There is no more beauty. And there's no more imagination. And there are no frontiers left to conquer. And you know why? Only one reason why. One reason why. The same attitude that you 3 guys are giving me right here in this room today. And that is, nobody cares.
Look on the wall behind you. Look at that little girl's face. I know you've seen it. But you know what she's never going to be able to see? She's never going to be able to see the simple wonder of a leaf in her hand. Because there's not going to be any trees. Now you think about that.
Welcome back to The Roundtable. I'm Joe Donahue. Bruce Dern is our guest for this hour. He turns 80 years old on Saturday and will celebrate the occasion with a tribute as part of this weekend's Berkshire International Film Festival. It will be Bruce Dern Day at the Mahaley on Saturday. The film Silent Running will be shown at 4 o'clock, and then at 7 o'clock, Dern will be in conversation with the director of Silent Running, Douglas Trumbull. Their onstage talk will be followed by a screening of the movie, Nebraska, which earned Dern his second Oscar nomination, his first coming home. Dern spent years as a character actor working with some of the biggest names in Hollywood, Alfred Hitchcock, Betty Davis, Joan Crawford, Robert Redford, Jack Nicholson, John Wayne, Olivia de Havilland, and Sean Connery, just to name a few.
I'll tell you something. When I first came to Hollywood, Joe, we were very lucky, my generation, because we still got to work with the legends. There's no legends anymore. You can't be a legend. I mean, Clint's close to a legend because he looks good on a horse and he's given back. And I guess Redford has legendary because he's given back. But outside of giving back, you can't be a legend. Well, those people were all legends because no one knew what they did after school. They even know what we do at recess. But these people were not followed or anything, so they could be big. And that was a privilege. And of all the legendary people I got lucky enough to work with, and Jack will tell you the same thing, they were so pushed us to push ourselves to the edge and take risks and be not just better than we were, but keep trying, keep inventing. Because for some reason, they felt we were kind of a unique group of guys and girls that they hadn't seen, because none of us, except the two or four mentioned, were obvious movie stars. We all were character actors that had spent years and years playing little roles and whatever it was, not making a whole lot of money, but so forth and so on. As the age gets on, finally you get into your 30s. And the most wonderful thing I ever heard said about the whole idea of it all is the fact that we made a movie in 2006 called A Decade Under the Influence. It's a documentary. The last thing is I'm the last actor. They keep going back and forth about the movie. Ted Demme directed it. The last actor they come to is me. And then they say, well, what are you going to do when you retire? I said, retire? I'm still just trying to learn and get better. I have a lot of stuff I have yet to do. I wouldn't direct. I don't understand looking through the eyepiece. I take a Polaroid. I wouldn't know how to do anything. And furthermore, if you think I'm going to retire so Jimmy Caan can get another part, you're wrong. Marty Scorsese comes on, and he says, I'm absolutely blown away by the movies they make today. I wouldn't know how to make one like that. The wizardry, the technology, the propensity to make money fast, meaning 100 million in a weekend. And that kind of technology and just absolute stuff is so amazing. It takes one's mind a whole different place. Yet at the end of the day, I miss the people. I make movies about people. That's why I'm here. I think that's a lot of why it took me so long. Nobody saw A Tattoo. Nobody saw After Dark, My Sweet. Nobody saw King of Marvin Gardens. It took 6 months for people to find Coming Home. Movie after movie. And The Driver, a good film, a wonderful film Walter Hill made with Ryan O'Neill and I and Isabella Gianni. Walter Hill's a wonderful filmmaker, and he writes it.
I respect a man that's good at what he does. I'll tell you something else. I'm very good at what I do. Now, last night... Oh, I forgot. His memory's not too good about last night.
I remember everything.
Alone in your room?
Yeah.
You can do better than that.
Charlton Heston told me something. He also went to my high school. He said to me, I was doing a movie that he was in called Will Penny, in which he was very good in, incidentally. And he said to me, you know, an actor is really only as good as his next film. That's the way I look at it. I'm looking beyond. And as far as Nebraska fits into that, right now, I'll start there. Because that's when I was made aware that A lot of people and actors have said that they don't like me in their movie. Ryan O'Neill told it to me. Edward Norton told it to me. And they would tell you that. They said, I'm not sure I wanted you in the movie. I said, why is that? Because everybody says you and Jack Nicholson get up too early. Well, give me a break. I mean, I sleep later than anybody else and anything. It's just that we take advantage of everything we see when the switch is on in front of us, around us, whatever surrounding, and feed off it and put it in the character. And a lot of people think, well, that's bullying. You bully. And, you know, in Nebraska, you bullied Wilford K. Get off my back. Movies are the greatest teamwork. Being a runner, I was never, and I still race, I was never on a team except a relay team. And movies are, you're only as good as the man next to you, the man in front of you, the man behind you. You're a team, and you become a family. And that's why I don't go to rap parties, because it's very hard for me to say goodbye. It's very rare, as strange as it'll sound, that you run into the same people until you get to be my age, and then they're just there, but they're all children of. And I am no undertalk. One of the greatest thrills I had in my life is not that I'm on the boulevard, but the same day they gave me a star on the boulevard, they gave one to Diane, my ex-wife, and to Laura. Right. And we are the only family, sir, who all have stars on Hollywood Boulevard. There are other families, plenty, but no father, mother, child.
For the first time in the history of the Walk of Fame, and in celebration of the Walk of Fame's 50th anniversary, three stars will be dedicated at one time for a family dynasty of actors. Our honorees today include Bruce Dern, Laura Dern, and Diane Ladd.
If there was ever an actor who paid his dues, it's Bruce Dern. It seems like I grew up, or at least grew older, watching Bruce on TV. He was on everything, from Wagon Train to Outer Limits, from The Fugitive to Naked City, to Rawhide, Gunsmoke, Ben Casey, Bonanza, Thriller, Sea Hunt, the FBI, you name it, he was in it. And if he didn't get killed, he usually at least got arrested.
And we should note, there is 7 Oscar nominations between the trio. Bruce Dern was born into old money. His grandfather was George Dern, former governor of Utah, and President FDR's first Secretary of War. Eleanor Roosevelt was once his babysitter. His father was a law partner with Adlai Stevenson, who was also Bruce Dern's godfather. His uncle was poet Archibald MacLeish. But Bruce Dern was pretty much disowned from the family.
I did not get along with my parents. Anybody that reads about me or anything else knows that I was kind of persona non grata.
They didn't want you to be an actor.
No, sir. And anyway, and yet, my uncle, who lives not far from where you are, Archibald MacLeish, who was a 5-time Pulitzer Prize winner, right, and was a very famous poet, and was the Boylston professor at Harvard the last 30 years of his life, and lived in Conway right above the state line there, and everything, he got a pass from them. And I would say to my mother, my father had passed away before I had done anything. I was in dramatic school at the Actors Studio. I hadn't worked yet. And he said, my mother said to me, why do you insist on that? Why do you insist on going to do that, to be an actor? You act all the time. And I said, Mother, I'm doing it. That's all. And she said, well, consider yourself persona non grata in this family. And I said, and why does Archie get a pass? He gets a pass, Bruce, because he's a man of letters. Oh, I see. And that made me always think maybe acting isn't an art. But whatever it is, it's pretty interesting and unique. Yeah, we don't write music, we don't do this, and I'm not a man of letters. I'll never get over that. But I did not spend my life as my brother did. Our family owns a big department store in Chicago called Carson Peary and Scott and Company. And the MacLeishes are the Ann Company because my grandfather's father brought the store from Glasgow, Scotland to America and found 3 guys, Carson, a Peary, and a Scott, to be his partners. So we always maintained 51% of the store. My brother spent his entire life trying to prove to my grandfather that he could be my grandfather, McLeish, and he couldn't. And it ended up killing him. He was in Hazelden 5 times. He put too much pressure on himself and never could live up to it. I didn't. I had nothing to live up to. That pissed people off, which is why I wrote the book. And I wrote the book to let folks know that Laura and I didn't fall off a turnip truck from here to Muncie, Indiana or something. You know, we arrived, had no help whatsoever. Laura did. She was a townie. Of course, we're there for her and everything. But Diane didn't. I didn't. A lot of people didn't. Jack didn't. Everybody had to make their way. And yet, at the same time, by making our way, we managed to accomplish things. My mother said to me when I was 11 years old, you know, I know you run. I was a speed skater before I ran. I know you run at practice. I know when you skated after school. But you're never home till 6:30, Bruce. So what takes you from 3 o'clock to 6:30 that's so important? I said, Mother, I have right now in my life one thing I like to do more than the athletics. And she said, oh, really? And what might that be? And I said, I love to f*** up. She didn't get it. And this is a woman who was married to my father, whose father was the first non-Mormon governor of Utah for 8 years, became Roosevelt's Secretary of War, George Dern, in his first cabinet. My godfather ran for president twice, Adlai Stevenson. No one knows who he is. They say, well, didn't it all really start with the Kennedys? Excuse me? He came to see me in Sweet Bird of Youth in 1959 on Broadway, Adlai did. We got to talking, and he said, I just want you to know how proud your family would be of you, of where you are today, in a play on Broadway, directed by Mr. Kazan and Tennessee Williams and so forth. Said to him, I said, let me ask you a question. Was there a difference between when you ran for president in 52 and then in 56? He said, Bruce, he took a long sigh, and he said, when I ran in 52, I ran against a man who couldn't be beaten. He was God-fearing. He was a good golfer. He just won the war. He was religious. He was a great politician. And he was basically an honest man. And he said, I thought I came in on a pretty darn white horse that year, but I got beat fair and square. And then he took a deep sigh, took a drink of water, and I said, and what about 56? And he looked at me, Joe, with tears in his eyes. And he said, Bruce, somehow in 56, that horse was a lot grayer, and I realized this is not for me. And when the Kennedy called me 3 years later to help with Chicago and help with West Virginia, and I was the lion of the party and everything, I wasn't really there for that. That's the most profound thing I ever heard from a guy, that he could look at what he did and say, it was different because I didn't see the horse changing color while it was, but it was changing. He put his arm on my wrist across the table, grabbed it as hard as anybody's ever grabbed it, including Arnold, and said to me, I want you to do me a favor. I don't ever want you to vote for that office until you see somebody on a white horse. Never voted.
You've never voted for president.
For president, no, sir.
I am assuming you don't see that this year, certainly.
Hardly.
Yeah.
Indeed not.
Yeah.
But somebody's got to do the job. I always used to say, well, what we need is a king. But then everybody said, well, the Kennedys are all dead. Well, one thing I didn't tell you that Adlai told me is the reason that he did not help the Kennedys out like he could have or should have, it didn't make any difference. He said nice things about them, was the father. He didn't care for the father, and he thought the father ran the whole show, which he did. And then the mother took over. That's the reason. They've never done a movie really about the father, but the father had, let's say, tremendous game, but it was bent at times rather severely in certain areas. Not that he wasn't a great man. There's one other thing I'll say. Thinking of what I said to my mother, I am always quite taken by people that get done. In the movie, RKO 247, which they made for HBO, which is about the making of Citizen Kane, at the very end of showing the movie to his girlfriend, mistress, wife, whatever you want to call her, Mr. Hurst starts leaving the room and walking down a staircase below the huge living room. The girl goes running after Marion Davies, screaming at him, "You you're this and that and the other thing. You think you're a great man. You keep saying what a great man you are. Well, you're not, because if you were, you could stop this movie from being shown, ever, anywhere." And he keeps walking, and he stops, and he turns around, he looks up at her, and he says, "Marion, I will not allow that kind of language in my home. And secondly, I never, ever said I was a great man. I quite simply said I was a man who had a chance to be great and wasn't." Come on, bud. I mean, what are we here for? You know, I don't want to be a great man. I don't desire to that, but Marty Scorsese is not wrong. It's about the people. And if we don't get more about the people into the business is going to end up being on a box in your house or going to an event once a year where they show something from beyond Pluto. And so far, the only one I know it went beyond Saturn is me and Douglas Trumbull, because I do it in silent running.
Right.
So shut the f*** up, people. You know? Anyway, I want to thank you so much for this time. You know, I appreciate it. Thank you also for something else. You do your homework, bud.
Thank you.
That's very amazing.
Much. Bruce Stern, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay, Joe.
Take
thank
care.
You.
Once again, the Bruce Stern tribute will be part of the Berkshire International Film Festival at the Mehewe Theater on Saturday. The film Silent Running will be shown at 4 o'clock, and then at 7 o'clock, Dern will be in conversation with the director of Silent Running, Douglas Trumbull. Their onstage talk will be followed by a screening of the movie Nebraska. You can find out more information about all of the events by going to BIFMA.org, BIFFMA.org.
Well, cut my legs off and call me Shorty. Is that General Sanford Smithers I see?
You got a good eye, son.
Well, I'll be double dog damn. General Sandy don't give a damn, Smithers. Captain Chris Mannix, Mannix Marauders.
Erskine Foy?
Yes, sir. May I sit down, sir?
According to the Yankees, it's a free country.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.